Hello. Before we begin our usual hilarious writing-themed blather, we just wanted to mention that it is World Alzheimer's Day on the 21st of September. And as this episode is pertinent to the theme, Tommy and I thought it might be nice to send a bit of love out to any of the million-odd people in the UK with Alzheimer's disease, or anyone who has loved ones suffering with dementia.
So we've left a link in the show notes to the Alzheimer's Society where you can find out more information or donate or whatever. But we just thought we'd mention it rather than just ignoring it, and because it was linked in a little bit with what we're going to talk to Emma Healy about, with the theme of one of her massively successful books. So we just thought we'd mention it. A little bit of a serious bit for once. Sorry about that. Bit awkward, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah. But obviously, dementia, Alzheimer's, is a terrible disease, and it affects not just the people that get it, but the families and everyone. And it's, it's something hopefully we can look to cure in the future.
It would be nice to do that, wouldn't it? It would be nice.
We're not going to do that, just to clarify. That's not on us.
That's not
one of our tasks.
A great deal.
We've not done. But hopefully with people donating and the scientists working hard, there might be some amazing medical breakthrough in the near future.
Lovely. Right, on with the show.
Okay, good morning, class. Excuse me, things on lips, please. Johnny, is there something more interesting on the front of Carla's blouse? Eyes to the front, please. Thank you. Right. Today, we're going to be watching a programme about writing in preparation for the work we're going to be doing later this term. Because, frankly, I got a bit drunk last night and I need a bit of quiet. Can you pull the blinds, please, Lucy? There we go. Lovely. Right. Just plugging this in. And...
Hello. This is the Failing Writers Podcast School's programming service. Let's dive straight in, shall we?
So, Tommy, our £500 500-word flash fiction competition is now in full swing.
It's literally ongoing.
It is.
And we've already had quite a few entries, actually, which I found interesting. Interesting psychology, isn't it? Of when do you send your entry?
Exactly.
Do you get it done, send it? I don't want to be tweaking with it. I'm just going to tweak and change it. Or do you sit on it, like Kathy said, put it in a drawer, have a look at it?
I think some people just can't do that. Like, they're not able to.
Yeah, no, I think there is something about, look, if I'm just going to be left with this, I'm just going to be tweaking and tweaking and tweaking.
Yeah.
I'm going to end up ruining it.
Just get it out there.
So if you haven't got yours in yet, get working.
Yeah.
And, do send us something in. We'd love to read it.
Yeah, it's been a really lovely, steady stream, isn't it? It's almost like the people actually listened to us in last episode.
Well, doing it in some kind of alphabetical order or high
order. They're orchestrating their entries. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Wonderful. Really is. Appreciate the effort.
Yeah, I have already put a couple in my long list.
Have you?
Have you spotted any that have caught
you? No, I thought they were rubbish. So I think everyone that sent one in, I think they're pretty poor.
So all the early entries.
Oh, terrible.
We can write
absolutely
off.
Terrible.
Well, so that's good. At least people know where they stand.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. No, I haven't properly read through any of them, really. So yeah, I need to. You're right. It's probably quite good, isn't it, to steal a little bit of a march so there's massive pile to read.
Yeah. They start ramping up, don't they? I seem to remember towards the end. Then it gets a little bit on top of you.
I will do that this week. Yeah. I'll have a little.
Do it. But yeah, keep them coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, 500 words of sublime storytelling could win you £500. And the closing date is the 29th of September. Yes.
Yeah. We should have said that's all in association with Scrivener, but we don't need to say that because here's an advert for them.
The thing is with Scrivener, order in a different write you can, and source it out all you four.
Hey, I don't think that's not really how it works, Tom.
Just type in any old nonsense. I love that password, Mr. Digit.
No.
And out pops a finished novel. And a finished novel.
Right, that is not how it works. I mean, it does help you organise stuff.
Why is this not working?
It definitely means you can shift chapters around and make notes and attach them to the right bits of writing.
Well, and just press the buttons and it comes out, doesn't it?
Link to web research so it's all at your fingertips and loads more. Basically, it helps organise your writing on another level.
It's not blooming working!
Plus, it's great for productivity too, because you can set daily word count targets, keep track of your writing progress and stuff like that. It really does do everything you need it to if you write. Whatever you write.
Why is it not written my book for me?
Well, you know, almost everything.
Get a 30-day free trial of Scrivener right now at literatureandlatte.com and use the code FAILING to get 20% off when you sign up.
So, yeah, the closing date was...
29th of September, 9 a.m. UK time. So it's not even nearly too late.
No, there's still time. There's
get
still
all
time.
The details at failingwriterspodcast.com.
So,
Tom, it's that time, isn't it?
John, what have you been writing?
Well, Tom, I haven't. Do you know what? I'm not even going to make an excuse. I've decided that's it for excuses. I'm done with them.
You're just going to quit writing?
I'm just going to stop.
I think that's a good decision.
Stop making excuses.
Based on your output and the quality of your output, I think that's not a bad shout.
I think you're probably right.
And there's a lot of people listening now nodding. They've literally given themselves whiplash. They're nodding that hard.
It's time, John.
Yeah.
Just give up.
It's been fine. A great run. It really has. Yeah. You've really set the world alight and you'll be missed. But yeah, it probably is time. No, so you've just been busy away doing stuff.
Yeah, I'm not going to make excuses.
Washing the dogs.
Yeah, I haven't done it. And I'm not going to apologise. I'm just going to be ballsy about it. Yeah, I've done none.
Well,
haven't done any writing, Tom. What about you?
Well, maybe for next time you'll be able to do some, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, come on.
Okay.
A couple of weeks, bit of a commitment.
I will do. Have you got, by the way, Tom, I was going to ask you this before. You got a favourite excuse for not writing?
No, I think it's good to mix them up, isn't it? So it doesn't get stale. Because if you come up with the same excuse each time, then that's obviously something that you need to address, which in itself is a bit of an annoyance. You don't want to be addressing issues in your life, do you?
That's true.
But if you mix them up, so you never quite know what the excuse is going to be, then it's not your fault. It's hands up time. You're just a victim of circumstance.
Actually, that's really true, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a very good point, Tom.
Yeah.
I think my top three are definitely busy with podcast, busy at work, obviously, and, like family and friends stuff, holidays, you know. That kind of stuff. I mean, it's obvious, really, isn't it? But it's usually the podcast.
It soaks up a lot of the creative time, doesn't it? That's the thing.
It does.
Because the other time isn't that time, because you can't do it in that time, because you're away or you're at a family meal or you're...
Exactly.
But the time that you do the podcast stuff is kind of the creative time. And unfortunately, it does kind of scratch that itch as well.
It does. That is really true. Because sometimes you are writing for it. Sometimes, you know, you're doing tasks and things like that. Well, I suppose that is still writing. That's fair enough, isn't it?
It is. Well, I mean, but you're just, the point of the whole thing.
You're just coming up with ideas for it.
Yeah. And then you think, I'm sated creatively. I don't need to do any more anything like that. I will just fritter away my hours and waste time willy-nilly.
Anyway, tell me what you've been writing, Tom.
Well, not as much as I would have liked, but that doesn't mean that I've not been working on my writing.
Okay.
I hit a little bit of an obstacle right in the middle of the story. So I've been working, thinking through that, and I think I've got something that means I can carry on.
That's
good. There was a turning point in the middle that needed my main character.
Some good writing.
Yeah, and I was like, wrong person for that, isn't I? So she needs to ask for something that's then going to have reverberations through the rest of the story. So if it's not the right thing, it just doesn't work.
So it's a kind of fulcrum point
in
the character
a little bit.
And the story.
But I think I cracked it sort of yesterday and a bit more this morning.
Oh, brilliant.
Or at least I think I've got enough to do it. And if it's wrong, the story will still roughly be in the right direction and can be changed on the second or third, fourth draft or whatever.
Oh, well done.
It's frustrating though when you're doing, I was doing really well with the first draft, just right forward thing. But then there's sometimes where you just hit something where you can't, because it does need
It needs an answer, doesn't it?
It needs the right answer, or at least nearly the right answer.
And that I find that's the time you need to go for a nice long walk or something. That's like, you can't just sort of sit staring at your screen somehow.
Well, it's funny, actually, you say that. I cracked it open, really, by picking up a pen and a notepad.
Oh, nice.
And going old school on it.
Mm.
And writing lots of things and arrows and doodles and asterisks and things. Yeah, so.
That's good. I suppose, in a way, it's still a change of scene.
So hopefully, next week, when you ask me,
sort of.
I'll be like, oh, yeah, that did. It was like, dam has been broken.
Well done. So are you like a little way past halfway now? Is that roughly?
I probably am about exactly halfway, I would think.
Midpoint.
Yeah.
Tricky midpoint.
We will see.
Well, that's good. That's good. One of us has been working.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
Yeah.
So, shall we have a little chat with our author this week?
Yeah. Who is it, John?
It is the very lovely Emma Healy.
Emma Healy? What's Emma Healy done, John?
At the age of 29, I think she was, she wrote a book called Elizabeth is Missing.
Yes.
Which is about an elderly woman with dementia kind of attempting to solve a crime. And that book became a massive hit.
It sold over a million copies.
I believe it did, yeah. And it won her the Costa First Novel Award, and it was made into a BBC film.
Yeah.
And she followed that up with a book called Whistle in the Dark, which was described by the Sunday Mirror as quirky, humorous, and entirely engrossing. So let's have a little chinwag with Emma Healy. Let's go back to the beginning. When and how did you start writing, Emma? Have you always done it since you were a kid?
Yeah, I've got, you know, like little books where I've written in like three of the pages. I've made like a whole book and then three of the pages are filled with like the beginning of a story.
Oh, I've got loads of those.
Yeah.
I haven't got them anymore, but yeah, brilliant.
And actually my daughter's doing that now, which is funny to see.
Oh.
I always had lots of, you know, ambitions. I was going to write a book and then it would fizzle out after a couple of pages. And then I started writing a bit more seriously in my teens, but not like in a kind of public way, just for myself, I guess.
Are we talking diary or are we talking like fiction? Or?
Like kind of, you know, what I thought of as being dark short stories or, you know, I won a poetry competition when I was 15 and that kind of made me think I could do it. Yeah, little things, I don't know, just bits and pieces. And then, like, you know, I'd show them to the odd person, but I wasn't... It wasn't some... I didn't really do it publicly, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Have you kept any of that? I don't suppose you've got any little excerpts of those early forays into writing for us to enjoy. Do they exist?
Not really. I mean, I can't remember. The poem probably exists somewhere, but I'm sure it was absolute trash. It was just, you know, it was quite a local competition. I imagine they didn't have that many entries.
Yeah,
you made it sound really
like.
Big, Emma.
Oh, no,
you made it sound like you'd hit the big time early door. Oh, I won a poetry competition.
No, it was literally like Clapham Junction Waterstones.
Just at the local fete.
Yeah, no,
it was just, oh my
God. I mean, I did win £100 worth of poetry books, which was quite
Whoa.
Useful. Yeah, it was
yeah.
great.
Back then, that's a lot of poetry.
So, yeah,
back then, yeah, that was too... Yeah, it was a lot.
That's a lot of poetry.
You know, I still got some of those books. Some of them still unread. There's an Ezra Pound I still have.
Just what every 15-year-old
wants. Yeah, well, exactly.
Loads of poetry. How did you get on at school with your writing? Were you nurtured or was it difficult? Or how did it sit in your school days?
I had a great English teacher in my second year who was just incredibly supportive and lovely.
Brilliant.
He then later, I think, got let go because he lost a load of A-level papers.
Oh,
so he was sort of one of those uneven teachers. But he was really brilliant. He really enthused the whole class when it came to Shakespeare. Like we all as a class asked to do another Shakespeare play
wow.
instead of anything else because he was fantastic. But it was very much like within the class. And then other than that, I didn't particularly... I certainly didn't say I had an ambition to become a writer once I got to secondary school. It felt embarrassing. So I didn't really say anything.
What were you going to do? What was your ambition? You know, when you're kind of that sort of mid-teens and you think you know what you're going to do, what was it?
Well, I wanted to be a litigator is what
they
said, but that was just because the dad in Clueless looked like he had a really cool job.
Yeah, it's great how you base stuff
yeah,
like that, isn't
I don't
it?
Really. And my dad was like, that's not really going to be your thing. He was like, oh, okay, sure. So I didn't really have... I knew I didn't want to be a teacher because my mum was a teacher and it looked miserable.
Yeah.
So I was like anything other than that. But then I really massively failed out of school. I like had a huge mental breakdown and didn't sit some of my a lot of my exams and just had
and
like,
kept getting teachers that lost all the papers.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like I didn't even get to A level, so like that was no issue for me. but yeah, so I just sort of had, and then I thought, because I was like, right, I can't get back into education, it's so appalling. I thought, well, I'll just...
So you left after GCSEs?
Then? Yeah, I got 4 GCSEs and just about, and then was like, I'm done. And my parents were obviously in despair. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to write Mills and Bean for a living because that looks like it'll be easy. so I tried. I mean, I was like, you know, 16, not massively experienced with men trying to write. Like, you know, they're all very like sexual books now.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it was, and also it was during that time when, so that was like the early 2000s when everything was about subverting something else. So I thought I was going to do something really clever, and rather than set it on like, you know, Greek Island or like in a like fabulous penthouse or whatever, I was like, oh, I'll do something like interesting and set it in a supermarket, which is like fun.
I was gonna say a Tesco's in Chorley or something like that.
Yeah, not why people read Mills and Boone, just that's absolutely
somewhere really bland.
To really escape. Really, do you know,
yeah, exactly.
Escape into a different world.
I'm gonna set it in a crack den.
Yeah, so I thought I was being clever, and obviously that didn't really go anywhere. And then I did end up going, I worked on like a portfolio of artwork and ended up going to art college, and so I just sort of went on that route. But I did do book arts. So I was kind of writing adjacent, and you could take a creative writing class in that, but I was so like terrified by the idea of doing anything too academic, because it had been so it'd been such a trigger for me that I wouldn't even do creative writing. So I did everything visual. And
you'd already peaked, really, hadn't you, with your massive poetry win and your Tesco Mills and Boone.
Right.
There was nowhere
to
else to go,
yeah,
was there?
Absolutely.
You'd hit the ceiling.
Exactly. So I had to find a new territory.
Yeah.
So I did that. I mean, book arts is great, but it was not... Again, I was rubbish at it. It was absolutely terrible. You had to be so neat and tidy to be a really good book artist, especially if you're doing... You know, it's all a lot of... Like, I can do the sewing, the pages, that's fine, because if it goes wrong, you just unpick it and do it again. Mm. But it's all glue. The next stage is glue. And so you have to be absolutely, like, so neat. Wow.
And you're there with your fingers stuck together.
Yeah,
and,
stuff stuck to me, like all these grubby marks from where I tried to rub the glue. Yeah. You know, and then the next person over on the desk would have, like, this pristine thing. I don't know, it wasn't... none of it was really for me. Just, you know, it came out a bit like... That's not going to be my...
No, I feel you on that.
So what happened between then and doing an MA in creative writing at UEA? Because you obviously became very serious about being a writer, because that's an investment, isn't it, that you don't sort of wander into casually.
Yeah, and obviously the academic thing, you'd obviously not been particularly keen on that previously. So that's quite a big turnaround, isn't it?
Yeah, what happened?
Well, I got a job, a proper job, and then I was like, this is shit, so what else can I do? and actually, even when I got the job that I really wanted, I thought I wanted to work in galleries, and I got my first like, proper job in a gallery. And I remember getting there and being like, oh, no, this is terrible. Like, it was a lovely place to work. It was nothing against the job. But I remember my friend wanted to get into film, and I wanted to get into galleries, and we'd both been working in a bookshop, and then we met up after we both got our supposed dream job. And she just went, but it's still work. Like, we were just absolutely outraged.
That's
like,
such a beautiful young person thing to say, isn't it? Just this realisation.
Just graft.
So then I was like, oh, maybe I should look back at doing some writing again. And like, I'd always had a little thought of it. And I did a correspondence course, I think it was at the Open College of the Arts, just because I thought that way I will be able to write, but no one will know. It'll be like a secret between me and this tutor, and that's that. So I did a little bit of that. And then I started to do some other short courses. So there's a woman called Vicky Grutt, who's a short story writer and also a lecturer in creative writing. She used to do at least short, like they're about, I think, a weekend, and you would go and, I don't know, it was in a pub and you would do a little bit. And she had Kathy Page there once as well, doing a kind of workshop on dialogue. So I did lots of little things like that. And I did an editing course with Anne Ayler, who also did short courses in London, I think still does.
And so you kind of built your way up, basically. You kind of doing bits and then
really tentative.
Felt confident enough to go for it.
Yeah, and I would, you know, when people would ask me what I was working on, I would always just say, like, oh, you know, maybe I want to write a short story. I'd make it very tiny. I started to write a novel, and then I was like, there's no way I would tell anyone. It sounded so embarrassing to say I wanted to write a novel, which now seems silly, but at the time I was like, God, how utterly embarrassing.
What was that about?
I think it just sounded so ambitious. I couldn't imagine that I would do it, so that it would be doubly embarrassing to have not ever managed. Whereas, you know, if you say you're going to write a short story, mostly people don't really ask you again. I don't know what that says about short stories.
Yeah, no one's bothered. No one's that bothered.
Yeah.
But a novel sounds like a real thing.
Yeah, and exactly.
Go, how are you getting on with that novel then? I mean, the stupidest thing you could do is probably start a podcast about it. That's probably one of the worst things you can do for that.
Well, except that actually then when I really got serious and I did a workshop again with Anne Ayla, did these workshops and I started going to those. And the first day, so basically what happened was you brought between 500 and 1300 words to a group of about, I don't know, a dozen people. And you had enough manuscripts for everyone to read, but you would just read it out in the class and then people would edit as they go, and then they would write something nice or nasty on your manuscript, just give it back to you, and then you would read it at the end of the session, like once you've gone home. And I remember doing that and thinking, like, really, this depends on how these people react to this one. Like, I think I brought literally 500 words. It was the shortest amount of words I could bring in. And then on the tube home, I thought, I'm not going to look. And then I did look. And all the comments were just unbelievably nice. Like, people very excited about the idea, about the writing, about, like, they found it moving, or they found it funny or whatever. And I think if they'd hated it, I would have gone off and tried something else. But I had that such a kind of, like, you know, hit, like that kind of endorphin hit. I was like, okay, maybe I can do another 500 words. Just like, my ambition was very small. And then that became Elizabeth is Missing.
Oh, right. Okay.
That was the very beginning of it.
So was that, were you writing that when you were doing the creative writing course at UEA?
Yes. Yeah. So I got to UEA with about 40,000 words of it already.
Right. Okay.
And then I finished a draft while I was there, and I did some other things, tried some short stories and things as well. Mm. But yeah, I really used the year at UEA to try and work on the novel, which I think in hindsight was the best thing, because I had an amazing year. I absolutely loved it. It was one of the best years of my life. But I think I have had friends who went in thinking they would begin something, or they would experiment. And actually, as much as the course tells you to experiment when you're there, it's not really the ideal place for it, because you're going to be ripped to pieces like three times a term. And if you're really solid with the project, which I was, I knew what I was doing. By then I'd had a year and a half of workshops with people in London. Like, just we'd had a kind of informal group that we met every week. I was used to being, you know, this doesn't work and this doesn't work. And I was like, great, give it to me. Tell me. Yes. I love it. My friend said, you're so weird. You love being criticized. And I was like, well, I want it to be good. I want it to be better.
Yeah. That's a great way of looking at it, really, isn't it? That's kind of like getting other people to do your hard work for you.
It
in
is.
Some respects.
It's actually a great skill, isn't it? Because it's very tempting to hide your work away or be slightly embarrassed about it, like you were saying before.
Yeah.
But to be able to take criticism is an amazing skill.
Yeah, so, you know, having a podcast all about failing as a writer is probably very useful for the future.
We're getting thicker and thicker skin throughout.
How long did Elizabeth is Missing take then, do you think, from absolute start to finish?
It was about 5 years in the writing,
right,
and probably an extra 6 months before I started writing it. And yeah, so because I thought about quite a few members of my family, extended family, had dementia at the time.
Yeah.
And so it kept coming up, and I kept wondering what it was like and thinking about it. And also, I've been trying to write the quintessential novel, you know, like, young woman in her 20s in London and had jobs and boyfriends and blah, blah, blah. And it was just so unbelievably tedious. I just hated it, and it felt both really exposing and also just dull. And then so I thought, well, I'll write something that's definitely not me. No one can accuse me of
fighting. I'll just write some massive award-winning first novel. Instead, I'll do that. Because it did, it swept an awful lot of awards, didn't it? It landed really, really well.
Yeah, it did do well. Yeah, I was very happy. And it sold a lot and it changed my life, really.
Did you have any sort of inkling what a phenomenal success it would be?
No.
Beforehand,
I love the idea. Just Emma walking around going, "This is massive. This is awesome."
But sometimes,
by the way.
Sometimes
it's not
people
published yet or anything, but this is amazing.
But sometimes people read things and they go, "This is going to be massive." You know, were there people telling you this is going to be huge, or were they keeping your feet on the ground?
My husband, who's my boyfriend at the time, when he read it, so I met him when I got to UEA, and when he first heard the idea, so he'd been working in a bookshop, and of course everyone wanted to be a writer, and he was like, he's not interested in writing at all. And when we first met, he was like, "Oh, you know, what are you studying at UEA?" And I said, "Creative writing," and he was like, "Oh, shit." I'm so sick of writing.
Not another one.
Yeah. And he was like, "Oh, okay, go on then, what's it about?" And I told him, and he was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, that actually, you know, it's not just you talking about how you're miserable and, you know, or kind of like, yeah, it's not just a kind of autobiographical thing. So
you mean the other book you were going to write?
Well, exactly.
It's a good job you've moved on by then, isn't
Thank
it? Otherwise,
goodness,
things could have turned out different. You'd be like, "Oh, not another one. Yeah. Oh, that old one. Yeah. 20-something girl in London. Yep, good. Good luck with that then."
You probably never have asked me out. So I think there was a little bit of a sense of it was always surprising when whoever I told, they'd always be surprised that's what I was writing. I mean, I'm kind of surprised looking back, you know, now in my late 30s, the idea that when I was 23, I was just like, "Oh, I'll just write about an 81-year-old with dementia. That seems fine."
Yeah.
Like, now I would think, "Oh my goodness, I don't have anywhere near enough experience for that." But when you're young and you're kind of, you know,
do you miss that then? Do you miss the youthful bluster that you had when you wrote Elizabeth is Missing?
Yeah.
Or do you feel like you've moved on? You've got enough, you know, experience. You've got more experience now, even though you miss the, you know, the temerity of youth.
I think maybe the culture's moved on slightly, that we're all a lot more self-conscious about our permission to write. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
I think even so, kind of mid-2000s when I was starting to write a book, it just wasn't a question. People just, you just wrote, as long as you did it well, you could write whatever you liked. Whereas it feels now like you have to justify. I mean, a little bit, I had to do that anyway. You had, you know, lots of people asking me how it was I could write about dementia, and I felt like I had to, you know, trot my grandmother out all the time. Like, it felt a bit uncomfortable.
Mm. But presumably you did your research, you know.
Oh, yeah, I was really
as well
serious
as you could
about that, and I did tons and tons of research. Yeah, absolutely.
You can tell reading it because, there's so many, like both my grandparents have dementia, and there are so many brilliant little moments in it that just ring true, that feel very familiar.
Oh, I'm glad.
And yeah, and I think that is the difference, probably, is, I mean, knowing people, first of all, that had dementia, but also, you know, doing a lot of research on it. Because, yeah, it definitely rings true, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, thank you, it's really kind of you saying that. And yeah, I didn't approach it lightly. I was very serious about getting it right, but it still feels quite an audacious thing to write about.
Yeah. So that, Elizabeth Was Missing, that was made into a film with Glenda Jackson playing Maud. I didn't even spot that until recently.
Were you disappointed that they couldn't find a bigger female lead for it?
It was very exciting.
I've not actually seen it because I only just found out that it was made. But were you pleased with how that came out?
Yeah, because so it was optioned before the book was published, which is often what happens, because obviously if you option a book before it's successful, you get a better deal.
Right, yeah.
And so it was quite exciting to be optioned, and I met the production team. And then I didn't really hear very much, and like all these, I mean, like, I think you guys all know quite a lot about screenwriting. It all kind of goes quiet, and you don't really hear very much. And I didn't work on the screenplay.
I was going to say, you weren't involved at all with the production. You were just kind of hearing odd things occasionally.
They did ask me if I wanted to be, but I just said, you know, I have no experience. And I'd heard some horror stories about authors trying to get involved in projects and things, so I was like, "Oh, I think I'll leave that."
Take my baby and do what you want with it.
Well, I also felt like I was it's exciting to see what someone else would do, and they're very enthusiastic. And then I did get a script, I can't really remember the timeline, but maybe a couple of years later, and they had changed it a lot. They changed the story, really, the end, certainly the ending, but there's quite a lot of different things in the story. To almost like a slightly uncomfortable, like I didn't actually mind the ending change, but there was an extra character which I felt uncomfortable about. Anyway, I fed back. I said, like, I felt that was kind of a bit odd and uncomfortable. And there's a kind of special needs character who was going to be hanged at the end. And I just was like, this feels like it's putting weight on something that I wouldn't have written. But anyway, fine, it's yours now. So I assumed they would just be like, ugh, whatever, like the author says this, but we don't really care. Just from what I'd heard about the way that adaptations work, I didn't expect them to listen. Anyway, then again, I heard nothing. And finally, the project was greenlit by the BBC and they sent me the script and I just couldn't face reading it. I just didn't read it. They said they didn't really need any feedback. They just wanted me to see it. So I was like, fine, I just ignored it for ages.
Yeah, we're not going to change anything, but we just want you to see it.
Yeah, there's a kind of feeling of like, if there's anything really important, but I just thought, I don't want to get my hopes up. I don't want to interfere and be a pain in the ass, but I also don't want to say, I hate this, and then they ignore me. So I just thought, right, I'll just leave it. Doesn't matter. I'm just interested in seeing what they do. And then they started to talk about the fact they were going to film it and did I want to go and see. And so it was getting very close to it actually being a real thing. And my agent was like, have you read the script? Like, do you think maybe you should? Like, it might be time. So I finally read it and I was really shocked about how faithful it was. It was just, they had taken out everything that I had been nervous about. I don't think because of my feedback necessarily. I just think within the, you know, there's so many drafts they'd kind of pared back to the kind of original material.
The good stuff, basically.
Well, I thought she did a really neat trick at the end when she changed the ending and I quite liked it, but it did change things a lot. So I guess maybe they thought that was too much. And then I went up to see it being filmed in Kirk and Tillich.
Did you meet Glenda then?
Yeah.
How exciting.
That was lovely. Yeah, and she was amazing. You know, she was filming this bit near the bandstand where she has to fall over, like it's written into the book that she has a fall. And she fell over. And, you know, she's in her 80s. She just kept falling until she was exhausted and they had...
Sorry, Glenda, we haven't quite got that one yet. Could you just plop down on the floor again?
I actually felt incredibly guilty for even writing the scene in the book, watching her do it. And then eventually they did change it for someone dressed up as her. You know, they changed the shot so that she could stop falling over.
Thank God for that.
But it was quite amazing to watch.
Incredible. That was her last main role, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's done a couple of things since. But yeah, and it was lovely because she got a BAFTA, which was the one award she hadn't got yet. So it was nice, yeah.
This electrifying podcast you've currently got your ears glued to is the amazing and incredible Failing Writers podcast, which is so great, you've got to see it to believe it. But you can't see it because it's audio only, so you probably don't believe it, which is fine, because it's actually quite disappointing. So.
Well, so that book obviously became a huge success, and deservedly. But after you've had a massive success like that, both with awards and with the reading public, where the hell do you go next? What was that like, that just sort of sudden vacuum beyond that book?
I call it the void, and like my husband was like, oh my god, that's the
abyss.
Yeah, that's the worst bit. I just didn't really know what to write next. A lot of people I was told have books in their kind of bottom drawer that they tried first, and so people kept asking me, like, oh, have you got anything, you know, you maybe started working on before? And I was like, no, not anything that was, you know, that was more than a fragment.
Just imagine you going, 20-something, no, I haven't. Definitely haven't.
I had nothing. And I kept thinking I had something, and I wrote about 25,000 words of one thing and then scrapped it, and then 40,000 words of another thing and scrapped it. And it just was like, oh my god,
now you're talking our language.
Yeah. Was there ever like a moment of genuine panic in there?
Oh God, yeah.
Maybe this isn't possible.
Yeah, especially because in the US I had a 2-book deal, and the way that works is that they give you your advance for your second book, but if you don't deliver a book, you have to pay the advance back.
But that doesn't exist anymore because I've already spent it.
Yeah, well, I was absolutely, I really didn't want to give the money back. So I was like, oh, shit, I've got to do something. Like, I've got to find an idea. It was a couple of years of like absolute blind panic. And I had done so much touring. So all of 2014 and most of 2015, I was touring the book. It was just, wow. It was pretty relentless. And it was good, but because I did a course with Giles Foden at UEA, and he, one of his lessons, he said, if you're ever lucky enough to get published, say yes to everything. It's like, you just go, like, you know, don't ever think you're too good for the publicity, like, do everything. And I really took it to heart, so much so that after about 2 years, my publisher was like, could you just maybe say no? Like, this is actually a bit ridiculous.
So much so, you're here on the Failing Writers Podcast. Yeah.
If ever there was evidence that you will just say yes to everything, this is it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did a photo shoot for my German publisher, and it was 5 hours. The guy just was relentless. And it was in London, and at one point he had me lie on the steps up to the DLR. And afterwards I spoke to my foreign rights agent about it. She was like, how's it go? And what happened? And I explained, and she kind of looked at me like I was an idiot. And she's like, you know, you can refuse sometimes.
5 hours, that's, yeah, wow.
I'm very biddable, so I just kind of was like, yeah, sure. He kept making me do, like, costume changes. I had to, keep changing my top in public. It was absolutely ridiculous. I should have known better.
But at least you got that classic shot of lying on the steps on the Docklands Light Railway.
For that in-house magazine as well, for like one article.
Yeah, it's up there, isn't it, with the Beatles across Abbey Road. You know, it's just an image that people...
I'll have to try and dig that out for the episode.
For the cover shot for the episode, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Yeah. So when did the idea for Whistle in the Dark pop up then? And was it a blessed relief, or were you not sure until you'd worked further into it?
It was kind of a relief. We went to Australia as part of the tour, and there was this news item that I was really fascinated with, where a woman had gone missing in the bush, and she went missing for, I think, 15, maybe even like longer, maybe 21 days, something like that. And when they found her, she was about something like a quarter of a mile away from where they'd lost her. She really hadn't got that far. They just hadn't been able to find her. And she was dehydrated, but she was okay. And I was just really interested in that mystery of where she'd been. Lots of people thought she must have like run away, gone on a bender and come back. Or, you know, people didn't really believe she could have just been lost. So I was interested in that, but it wasn't really my territory. And so I thought, well, if I set it in England, how long could you go missing for without people finding you? And I thought more like 4 days. And then I'd been thinking about that a lot. What could I do with it? And so, as I mentioned earlier, I had a kind of breakdown when I was in my teens, and I was interested in looking at teenage depression, but not from the same point of view. Like, I'm never really that interested in looking at something that I know from my point of view. I always want to look at it from someone else's. So I thought, well, I'll kind of try and approach the subject as if, like, what did my mum go through, and maybe like think about it from that point of view. So then I had this teenage girl go missing for a few days, and the book begins when the girl is back but won't really say where she's been. And yeah, it was a much more literary book, if you could say it that way. Like, it's less commercial, it's more, you know, full of discourses rather than full of plot.
Feels very relevant for our times as well, because there seems to be an epidemic of teenage depression at the moment.
Yeah, like I felt that as well. It felt like it was something that was talked about a lot. But I was keen not to make it a book that had answers. It's mostly questions. I don't know. I'm very proud of it. And my agent still thinks that it's my best book, but it was a lot less commercial. So I'm pleased I wrote it. And yeah, my God, it was a relief to finally have a project to work on.
would you call yourself, such an ugly term, there must be a better term for it, but would you kind of think of yourself as an issue-based writer? I'm thinking that some writers like to take something that's generally kind of brushed under the carpet, or You know, take issues that might be facing a marginalized group of people and explore it, you know, and shine a light on it. Are you kind of consciously aware of doing that a little bit? I'm thinking of writers like Jodi Picoult or, you know, they're interested in obviously in the characters, but they kind of almost start with something that's a little bit unexplored or is an issue, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I totally do. I think I have quite a maybe overdeveloped sense of the book needing to exist for a reason. So I'm always quite jealous when you hear writers say that they had an image in their head and they just started writing and then the book kind of came from that. Because I always feel like I have to have, yeah, some kind of theme or, like, you know, there's something like 63 million books in the world or something. And I was just like, you know, why?
Is that all? Just 63 million?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe that's just in the British Library.
That sounds like not a lot.
So, yeah, I just was worried. Like, what, you know, why should I add to that?
Yeah. It's got to have a purpose. It's got to have something. Yeah. I think I feel a little bit similar to that, to be honest.
And I think it's a kind of, it definitely segues with like having really terrible writer's block, which isn't always good. But I remember having quite bad writer's block after Whistle, like during the pandemic, especially because, you know, it felt like there was this huge thing happening. I really had nothing to say about that. Yeah. And it's hard to concentrate on anything else. And then the kind of, you know, the kind of racial reckoning during that time as well. Again, really enormous subject, really important. But again, I couldn't really insert myself into that and say something useful. And so I really, really struggled to find something. And I was thinking about writer's block a lot. And I think is it Norman Mailer who said something about writer's block being a failure of ego. And that really struck me as true. You know, the issue is a kind of self-confidence that you can have something useful to say. And so, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say it was an issue writer like Jodi Picoult, who she really does, you're right, she picks something and she wants you to learn about it. It's kind of feels like a device for learning. But I do feel like I have to have something I want to say about a subject. And just writing about middle-class life doesn't feel like enough of a reason for me.
Yeah.
So what's the next reason going to be? What's the next?
Yeah, you said in the email you've just delivered a novel. It's very exciting. Novel number 3.
Yeah.
So I'm laughing because it's actually the fourth novel I've written, but I finally wrote my romance in lockdown.
Tesco's in Chorley?
No, but it is. I put it on Kindle under like a font.
As their eyes met over the Eccles case, Doreen said to Boris, "Why? I've been looking for someone like you."
But anyway,
use that if you want.
Thank you very much. I will write that down.
So you have put a book out under a pseudonym.
Yeah, well, I want to try it. You know, I want to see what it's like. And also, you hear people talking about Kindle and stuff, and I just wanted to see what the process is like. But anyway, sorry, that's totally irrelevant. So my third actual problem.
That's not irrelevant. Hang on, you've written another book. That's not irrelevant. Back up, Emma. Back up. What? Are you allowed? Are you keeping that secret? Are we allowed to know who wrote that?
Yeah, I am keeping it secret just because it would be pretty embarrassing.
Damn.
I think.
Okay.
Fair enough. Sorry, that's why I feel like
I'm going to find it. I'm going to do some kind of AI search on writing style, and I'm going to find it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Let me know how that goes. That'd be interesting to find out. It is on Wattpad as well for free. So.
Because you read a lot of Mills and Boone, didn't you, when you were younger?
Yeah. Loads.
So that was kind of fulfilling that little sort of bit of your sort of writing dreams in a way.
Yeah. To finally write one. Although not in the same sense. Yeah. Things have moved on a lot. Like, it's quite interesting. I find romance really fascinating anyway, because it really reflects something about society. Like, I remember I started reading them when I was about 16, and within like about a few years of me starting them, they've gone from, you know, the millionaire's secret baby to the billionaire's secret baby. And it was just interesting to see inflation reflected in romance in real time.
Yeah, totally.
So I find, I just think they're very pure stories, as in, you know, that it's about two people. You could literally just have the two people if you wanted. Mm. You know where it's going, so it's all that. I find it really fascinating. Also, they tend to be full of dialogue, which is snappy dialogue. Yeah. So I finally fulfilled that dream.
Yeah. I saw a Guardian article. I think you described Mills and Boone as like almost literally saving your life. Like they brought you, you know, a kind of, I suppose they're all happy endings, aren't they? And
yeah,
there's a kind of, I don't know, are they quite sort of cathartic and escapist? So
yeah, absolutely. They're completely, and they're so easy to read.
Was there a little bit of that in the back of your mind when you were writing it? Like, I'm writing this for my 16-year-old daughter potentially in the future.
Well, also, I love the romance Reddit where women talk about the books that they've read, and there are loads of women who just like, they just need something to get through. But it's like a kind of crutch. And like, I knew someone who, she had a sister who was like heavily disabled, and she was her main caretaker, and she would read Mills and Boone because they were exactly the right level to like keep her going throughout the night when she was staying up with her sister. And so I think lots of things. And also the other thing about romance is you know that the women are going to be okay in the end, whereas so many books, like horrible things happen to women, and you can't guarantee your star, you know, who's going to be alive at the end or whatever. And with romance, you know that it's all going to be okay. Like, I think when you're 16 and the world seems absolutely terrifying, it's quite reassuring to find like, oh no, every story is going to be okay, and specifically the woman in every story is going to be okay. And I think that was important.
Sorry, anyway, I kind of interrupted that. We're back onto official novel number 3.
Oh, yes, yes.
So you said you've delivered a novel. I'm not totally sure what that means. Does that mean like fully edited, pretty much finished, or like a draft you're happy with? What does that mean, delivered a novel that's pretty much
ready
done?
To be sold, I guess. So,
great.
So it's just being sold. I feel like I'm being a little bit mysterious, and I'm sorry. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say and all this kind of thing.
But, no, that's fine. Probably not that much, hey? That tends to be the case.
You've probably already said too much. You're probably in an awful lot of trouble already.
I could tell you what it's about. I just don't know if I'm allowed to reveal like titles, or I don't really know. So
just give us a rough idea. But is it another issue-based novel?
Sort of. It's kind of a thriller, and it's about woman who is a personal trainer, and she's come out of an abusive relationship, and she is in the gym one day doing her job, and then the ex-boyfriend comes in and she thinks, oh, here we go again, like he's gonna come and harass me. And she realizes that he's actually blind and he doesn't know who she is, and she makes a kind of split second decision to train him pretending to be somebody else. And the rest of the book is really whether she can get away with it, and what she'll do if she is getting away with it.
And is this another book with like a, because you like a strong thread of mystery throughout your books, is it one of them?
It's probably more suspense than mystery. You do find out a lot about their relationship before. It's also a lot to do with dieting and exercising and the kind of, you know, obsession that comes along with that, and that feeling of needing control in your life. So I guess there is some kind of issue in there.
sounds like there's quite a few,
It seems to take an inordinate amount of time for a book to go from like the finished version of a book to the bookshelf. When can we expect to see that in bookshops? Is that years off?
Well, they're talking about it being January 2025.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, which I guess is less than 18 months now, but it does.
That's quick in book terms, I think.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I've quite often been rushed out. So Elizabeth's Missing, I was sold the kind of contract finally was done in the May, and it was out the June after, so the June the year after. So that was quite fast, especially for Adobe.
Can I ask you, Emma, just before we leave you alone, how do you actually find the process of writing? Do you find it a real struggle, or are you one of those people who just, you know, you just get up every morning and you just love smashing out a couple of thousand words?
No.
Oh, that's good to
hear. I mean, when it goes well, it's the best feeling in the world. You know, when I've written a scene and I think it works and it's exactly what I wanted to say. Like, it's there's no better high. But no, there's so many moments of like real despair, and I hate not having a project. I hate not having an idea, which is what I'm in at the moment. I'm just writing stuff randomly at the moment, trying to find the next book. And yeah, like, I mean, so my husband is kind of officially my assistant, and he was trying to explain to someone what he does for a living. And he's like, basically, I'm held hostage in the kitchen while Emma, like, basically won't let me go anywhere while she works, and then says, hold on, wait there, because I'm just going to read something out. And then 2 hours later, I'm like, oh, no, don't worry, I don't need you. And he's just sitting there waiting. I think, I mean, he's the real hero. it's lots of misery. And actually, this book that I've just delivered, like, this time last year, I thought it was dead. Like, I sent a draft to my agent, and she was like, I don't really know what this is. Like, I understand the idea, which, yeah, and I see, you know, I see where you're going with it, and the bits that are good, but she's like, but it feels like a kind of, you don't really know where you want to take it, or whether it's going to be like a psychological thriller or a very kind of meta kind of book, or what you're doing. And I was like, oh, I don't know either. So I just kind of, I just was like, oh, well, right, next idea, which I am very good at abandoning projects, so that's always a risk for me. Then I ended up working. I kind of couldn't let it go, and I kept working on it. But I love editing, which I think is really important.
Right, okay, interesting.
And I have friends who won't edit or really hate editing, and I feel really bad for them, because I think that is kind of sometimes the most... that's kind of the exciting part where it all starts to come together.
Does that mean that you get excited about editing at the end, or are you a bit of a tinkerer as you go? Do you tend to sort of edit as you go, or are you get the first draft out and then worry about what happens next?
No, I definitely tinker as I go. Like, I don't understand how people can do that.
Yeah, just write forward, just keep going.
Vomit draft, or, yeah.
I struggle with that.
Yeah, and also, you know, even things like Morning Pages, I've tried all the kind of Julia Cameron and Dorothea Brand type Morning Pages, or just where you, I'm trying to think of the... I was going to say spaff it out, but I was trying to think of a better way of phrasing that.
You can say that on this podcast. That's fine.
Great. It's not even, you know, like sex specific issues, something else, like gosh it out. Sorry, massively lowering the tone.
I was going to say toss it off, but no, that's just bad. No, but we know what you mean anyway.
I don't understand how you can do that. If I do that, it just becomes a kind of whinge fest of like what I would like to say and what I want it to be and what it's not doing and what I can't think of. And whereas, yeah, at the moment I'm just doing 100 words a day of a very polished bit, like a little microfiction that's absolutely polished, because then I feel like I have to create something every day, so that's good practice.
Nice. Yeah.
But I also have to edit something every day as well, so it's kind of, it feels like, and then you never know, I might find something that I like enough that I can do something with later.
Are you quite a tight plotter before you start, or do you just kind of go with the flow?
A bit of both. I used to think I was you know, because there's planner and pants or whatever it is, and I thought I was a planner, because, you know, you see, like, there's a kind of, people used to put me in that category because I said I kept a plan and then it was missing as I went, which I did,
right.
But actually it was a more like a record keeper. I tried to always know what I've written, where I think it might go in the book, and what might come next. But if I plan too heavily, I just find I have no interest in writing the book. So that was one of the projects that I scrapped, was that I wrote 40,000 words and it felt like I was just moving my pawns around, you know, then he must go here and then she must say this, because I knew everything about it. I knew, you know, what the ending was and everything. And I don't write chronologically. So
if you do that as well, it's hard to guess, or it's hard to think from a reader's perspective, because you know what the ending is going to be. It's very hard to kind of work out whether that's going to be easy to guess what's going to happen, if you know what I mean. Whereas If you have no idea what the ending is, then nobody does.
There is a bit of that. I mean, you can also write yourself into an like awful corner, which I've done pretty much every time I've written anything. And I've often, I think every single book I've written has had an extra bit of plot that I've written loads of and that's ended up scrapped, or that like there was going to be a long lost son and Elizabeth is missing.
Right.
And there's a whole other thing about keeping Elizabeth under a different name, or, you know, like a crazy, really involved plot. And then Whistle had the same thing, that I had a whole other section. It's going to be two parts, and the second part just got scrapped. So I end up wasting a lot of time worrying about plot because I haven't thought about it. But yeah, I think that you can sometimes, like, you're right, you can sometimes feel when an author is too sure of where they're going, that it just feels like it's a bit plodding, maybe, or
yeah,
I don't know.
Then in a ridiculous way, it feels like it's already been written, which I know is stupid because obviously it has, but that feeling as a reader that you feel like you're being taken on a journey, and it could, do you know, it's dynamic. There is that different sense, isn't there? We're being led down the path here.
Yeah, I think that's totally it, because it's that balance between an author who is in charge of their material and you feel like comfortable to let yourself be drawn in. So that's great. That's always a lovely feeling, like, yes, they know exactly what they're doing. But yeah, it can go over into kind of manipulating the reader in some way, and that's really uncomfortable.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So don't do that. There's a tip from an award-winning writer. Don't do that.
There's some people who are so good at that, aren't there? Like, who really plot every moment. And but I think it also depends on, like, I'd love to be the kind of writer who can bring a kind of quirky is an awful word, but quirkiness to every scene that surprise. Like, I was thinking someone like Don DeLillo or Patricia Lockwood, who they just, it's a reasonably ordinary setup and they somehow make it really incredible and strange and clever. But they can bring that to any scene. So you can imagine, I don't know how they work, but you can imagine even if they plotted out every scene, they'd still manage to make every scene surprising. That's so much of writing is about being honest with yourself.
And what's endlessly fascinating about writing as well is that everybody's got such a different way of doing it, which just seems bizarre.
Yeah, and for every book as well. Every book I've written differently. Like, this latest book, I wrote part of it as a NaNoWriMo project, just partly out of desperation because I just felt like I was getting nowhere. And I've never done that before. And actually, it was horrible. I absolutely hated it. But so I wouldn't recommend it. But obviously, that's, you know, it's totally personal, because I felt like I was having to rush it and it didn't really work for me. But I really wanted to. I'm also quite obsessive when I get onto something, which I think is quite a good, generally a good thing for a writer to be. So I did finish it in the NaNoWriMo period. But I would never have done that before. It was always a slow build up before.
So Emma, just before we let you go, give us what do you think the one biggest tip is that's going to change us from being wannabe failing writers into multi-international award-winning handsome authors?
That thing about honesty is probably the biggest thing for me, is just constantly having to be really honest with yourself. You know, like, I've met so many people who will say, oh, I will write my novel and I just need 5 clear hours every Saturday or something. Yeah. You just think, yeah, that's never going to happen. Like, that's not life. So be honest with yourself. Say, actually, I can't really do it at the moment, or I actually don't have the focus, or I'm not really willing to set aside a certain amount of time. And that's fine. You don't actually feel guilty about that. And also things with schedules, you know, people who think that they are morning people and they really aren't. So, you know, some people try and get up at 5:30 to write, and I just think there are very few people that really...
No, I don't get how you don't just fall to sleep while you're trying to write if you do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I definitely would.
Well, that's great advice to end on. Thank you so much.
It was lovely. It was lovely.
Thank you, Emma.
Bye.
So thanks to Emma for having a chat with us. John, we spoke a little bit before this podcast and you came up with an interesting point that is, like you said, this is really obvious, but I think it was interesting nevertheless.
Yeah, I think the thing that, yeah, the thing I was thinking about was, I think it says a lot about how tough the industry is when someone, i.e. me, who thoroughly enjoyed reading someone's first book, hasn't yet read that same writer's second book.
Wow, yeah.
And it's been out for 5 years.
Yeah.
There are just so many books to read, and I feel like, you know, even well-established writers must feel like, what do I have to do to get people to read this book?
Mm.
But I think, yeah, the difficulty in selling your book suggests maybe, and especially for someone who's who's writing a debut novel, it suggests just how important the concept of your novel is. If you can come up, basically, if you can come up with a really interesting angle on a story, you've got a miles better chance of selling your novel, obviously, because it's just much easier for an agent or a publisher to, you know, sell that concept on. It's just easy to grasp, isn't it? You know, you've sort of done the hard work for them.
Do you know what? When you said that, though, it immediately made me think, well, of course, John, stupid point to make. It reminded me back to obviously doing the log lines.
Yeah, yeah.
And how important, you know, how it needs to be completely soluble within two sentences.
It needs to be exciting, doesn't it?
It needs to be an idea where someone goes, oh, God, I can see how that would.
What happens next? You want to know what happens
when
next.
And all these scenarios pop up in your head of what might happen.
Yeah. But it's amazing how many, or it's amazing how few novels have a really crisp, you know.
Well, it's a hard thing to come up with, isn't it, really, to have that? Because they need to be, they need to have that beautiful thing of being so simple, yet so deep and full of potential.
That's it.
Because the ones that you think, oh, God, well, yeah, God, that's so simple.
I was thinking, this sort of led me on to think, how hard is it to come up with a really high concept?
I would imagine it's pretty easy.
That's
really,
what I was thinking.
Yeah.
How hard can it be? And what we should try and do, Tommy, is come up with, I was going to say, one high concept idea for a novel, but screw that. Let's come up with three each.
Yeah, I've got loads. Yeah.
And we'll just bang them out now.
Yeah.
Are you up for that?
Yeah, and we'll just, these aren't for us to write. We'll let everyone else pick them up.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, if you want to take these ideas and run with them.
Write a best-selling novel.
This is our gift to you, listen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So do you want to kick off, Tom? Have you got anything bubbling up?
Yeah, and the trouble with doing these, I don't know if you found this, is that you kind of do them and then you think, has that already been done? Did I see that in a...
That's so
true. This first one, I think, that could be an interesting concept. And I thought, has this been done kind of in an episode of Black Mirror or something, or like in a slightly different way, but the same thing? So my first one is a bit of a paranormal one.
Ooh.
And it will be about a little girl who can see how long everyone has to live.
Nice. How does she see it? Have you not got that far yet?
Not important, John. It's just a log line. She just sees it. She senses it. She just
like everyone's got a clock on their head.
Yeah, she basically can, almost like she sees everyone just with a clock on their head, but she can sense it. What would you do with that skill? What would you do with that child?
When people found out,
she could be used for all sorts of stuff.
I think you'd have to. I mean, there'd be government agencies out there looking for her.
Would you hide her? Would you?
All manner of nefarious people.
Yeah, but they see, oh, brilliant. That's actually quite a good concept, isn't it? But it's been done so many times.
I see most ideas have been done in some way. It's the spin, isn't it?
Well, that's true. It's about putting the spin.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. There's something about it being a sort of innocent young girl as well. It's like she hasn't got an ulterior motive.
She's just completely normal for her.
She literally can just...
She doesn't even realise.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like a spin on Sixth Sense, isn't it?
This is the thing. But then that's how they say, you know, to pitch to agents and publishers, isn't it? It's like a...
Combine a couple of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. What would... So I've got one for you. And I'm trying to think what this would be. This would be a combo of several things, probably. So this is a kind of this is a thriller, but it's two people. It's going to be like a young male. I'm thinking like a building engineer or something.
It sounds thrilling already. Yeah, go on.
A foxy, intelligent female data analyst, and they're working late one night on one of the top floors of the Burj Khalifa, right? Highest building in the world. They're both waiting for the lift. They get chatting. And maybe they're just, you know, being a bit sort of angry, flirty.
Okay.
And the lift opens. There's a bloke in the lift already, and they get in. The lift closes. And when they go to press the button to go down, they realise that the bloke's actually going up to the maintenance floors. So they go on up with them. And then an alarm goes off and the lift stops. And they don't know why, but in their sort of trying to find out what's going on, they find, I don't know, like on a newsfeed or on their smartphones or whatever, that a world leader has just been assassinated in the lobby of the building. And slowly the man and the woman in the lift kind of piece together the fact that the other man in the lift is the assassin. So they're with him, but they're also having to kind of communicate cleverly without the assassin realizing that they know. And that's it.
I mean, I think that's quite a long log line.
That was more of a, yeah, you're right.
Story,
that was more of a setup.
Story.
You're right. That's more of a setup than a log line.
Yeah.
But,
right, yeah.
You know, I wanted to give you a little bit of extra. Yeah. A bit more for your money.
Yeah. It's got generic 1990s film vibe.
It does, doesn't it?
Kind of going on with it.
It does.
As a young Brad Pitt.
Yeah. There you go. Angelina Jolie would have been in
probably,
it.
Probably, yeah.
In the 90s. Yeah, it would have been a...
Would John Malkovich have been the assassin?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, yeah.
The good thing, though, if it was in the 90s, you'd be able to get some cheesy lines in there as well, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Although mobile phones wouldn't have had so much stuff on. But sometimes that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That could be good. Less info getting to them. Yeah? So that's one.
Yeah, I think you need to sharpen that up, you see. That's not the soluble... idea,
well,
is it?
Well, I suppose in a way it is. It's fine. It's that moment where you find out, because the guy's quite plausible. He's probably quite friendly. Do you know what I mean? He's not going to be one of those.
Yeah.
He's going to be quite charming, and they're all kind of getting on well. And it's that moment, isn't it, when they realise?
Yeah,
it's
but it's
bloody him.
But that idea isn't the idea, though, is it? Where someone goes, well, what if? That isn't the idea. That's not good enough, John. Is what I'm saying. That's unacceptable.
What you brought
to the table. No, but it's not got that. I think that concept is like such a squashed down, refined, simple thing.
Well, the concept is two people stuck in a lift with an assassin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as simple as that, isn't it? What do you do when you find out? That's the concept.
Okay. It needs a little bit of work.
He's not impressed.
No, I am.
You're not seeing it, are you? You're not seeing it.
I'm not, I can't. Yeah, I think for it to be a big concept... There have to be three people in a lift. One of them's an assassin, but none of them know who it is.
That's nice.
Because they like got knocked unconscious or something.
Okay. That's nice. That is better.
That's what you need. You need that.
Yeah, yeah. No, that is good. Because
it's really hard to describe, actually, what the thing is. I guess that's why it's hard to do. But it's like...
Well, you don't know as the audience. That works really well. Because then you've got to try and sort of... You're going to have to kind of communicate with the person that you think it's not.
It turns into like a parlor game, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's much better, Tom. It's good.
Yours was rubbish. There you go. And have you got any more that you need improving?
Come on, then.
Ah, right.
If you're so bloody good at it,
okay.
Tom.
Okay. Well, I think you can, like you said before, you can take inspiration from things that have been done before.
Have you copied an idea?
No, it's completely different.
Go on.
You wake up one morning and find out that shoes have never existed. Can you imagine that? Imagine that.
Yeah.
No one's got shoes.
Yeah.
And everything else is normal, but no one's wearing shoes.
Are you aware as well? You're aware that shoes have suddenly gone.
You've woken up and you want your shoes. You're going out, you want your shoes, but there's no shoe. Where have my shoes gone? And you think maybe the dog's eating them or something. There's no slippers or anything. Nothing. Nothing. Just socks.
No footwear.
Just socks.
Oh, it is. You're allowed socks.
It's just shoes, John. It's just shoes.
Yeah.
So imagine the hilarious scenes in this book where maybe they go bowling. There's no bowling shoes to put on.
Wow. People slipping around.
People just wearing socks.
Falling on their asses.
But then imagine the impact you can have by inventing things like football boots.
Wow.
Running shoes.
Mm.
Literally invent tap dancing.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah?
Mm.
And it would be nothing like yesterday.
Yeah, of course it... Yeah. Be nothing like that.
Doesn't, yeah.
Wow, Tom.
And then I got thinking, God, you can just do so many different ones on that theme. You wake up one morning and find out, wake up in a world where all of a sudden fish don't weigh anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the fish don't weigh anything. That's normal for those people. But you think that fish should be heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You wake up one morning, right? Think about this one.
Yeah.
In a world where tables have never been invented.
Whoa. Chairs, fine.
Yeah, it's chairs.
But everyone just sits
no
around
tables.
Eating off their lap.
Yeah.
Wow. That is amazing. Do you know what? Do you know what amazes me, Tom?
Mm.
The fact that you criticise my idea.
Do you get any more?
Oh, mate, have I got more?
Are these shorter than the last? Is this going to be like a little idea rather than?
Yeah, yeah. This is one line. This is one line.
Oh, good, good, good. I'm liking it already.
Women organize a global strike in order to address gender inequality.
Well, that's interesting.
Everything: housework, parenting, cooking, paid work, generally everything. We refuse to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the aftermath?
Yeah, that's got some. That's a good concept in terms of that kind of. Your brain starts. That's it, isn't it? Your brain starts going on the what if. How does that work then? What happens?
Yeah. Do you know why that's a good concept?
Why?
Because Katie came up with it, not me.
Right.
That was Katie's idea. It's good. It is good, isn't it?
Yeah.
You got any more?
Not really.
Come on, we can freestyle an idea. Freestyle it out. How about? I'm sure this has probably been done as well. But someone who how about a kid, like a teenager, as a joke, makes a deep fake video of President Biden threatening China with war for some reason,
mm-hmm.
If they don't do something, and then posts it online, and then It's all taken very seriously.
A bit like an updated version of the 1980s film War Games with Matthew Broderick.
Yes.
Wouldn't it?
So it's kind of
a real
about
good, modern, that's how it would happen now.
Yeah, it's like about the fragility of the sort of global political equilibrium or something.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I was thinking about what if there was a man who had a normal life up until this point and then something happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Spider-Man gets bitten by a spider, that's when it changes.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens, and then from then on, whenever he gets splashed with water, he turns into a fish.
Oh, back to the fish. But he doesn't weigh anything.
Yeah, well, that's where it came from. I was thinking fish. So I think it's like Teen Wolf meets the Little Mermaid meets
But if
Splash.
He's not near any water, he just dies. So he's got to flap himself to water.
Yeah, is that what happened in Splash?
I think so. It's pretty.
Is that basically?
It's pretty similar, isn't it? Yeah, if she got wet, she turned back half fish, didn't she?
Yeah.
She half fished it.
Yeah, maybe not that one.
Yeah, maybe a bit similar.
Yeah, scrap that.
I like that idea. Something popped into my head then when you were saying that. What if a bloke living very very lovely normal life with his wife, and then he finds a text on her phone that says something like, you need to kill him, and you need to kill him tonight.
Yeah.
Doesn't know if it means him or someone else, but his wife clearly is being urged to kill somebody. And she's such a lovely person. She's just the most normal, sweet person.
Did Katie suggest this one?
No, that just popped in there.
Right.
It just popped in there.
If there's anything behind that she wanted to... anyone.
I don't think she would have told me if she'd come up with that one. Kept that one to herself.
No, that's what they do, though, isn't it? The villains, they always reveal too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right.
Get cocky.
Yeah. My object today is to create a high concept. I say there's no debate, there's no contest. The way you might dictate a lot of big interest in your book is fabricator, nicely compressed. Log liner will leave them so impressed. Yes, these high concepts are amazing. They stay in my brain and make me want to read at high speed. I'm greedy for you to feed me with your words that need reading, absurdly exceeding expectations. With your conceptual explanations, you're leading me to water, to a sort of trap you caught a horde of readers in. You ought to, with a concept so high it's got no ceiling, reeling us in like a pie or something in a shop. Now let's stop, because that's not a very good analogy. This reminds me when last season we had some guests on from the world of TV, didn't we, when we were talking about our TV show pitch. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I found while I was writing notes in my notepad, like I said before, for my getting through my story block, I found some notes. I think we must have come up with an idea to pitch some Alan Partridge-esque shows to them, because I found a list.
But never got around to it.
Yeah, but I'd found some.
Oh, share, Tommy.
I obviously thought dogs was quite a good theme. people look, because
this was pre fish era, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I've got dogs like in a box that are written, you know, in big letters with an arrow coming off saying people love dogs. So that's kind of confirmed it in my own mind. So I thought there might be something in police dog camera action.
Oh, nice.
So it's like the police camera action, but
dogs,
just with the police dogs.
On them.
Yeah. I thought possibly the Great British Bark Off.
Nice.
So we're going around the UK trying to find the best bark with Judge Paul Hollywoof. That might have come first. And then maybe like a historical thing about dogs and wartime dogs.
But slightly more serious.
Dogging for victory.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Then we got off dogs completely. Maggie Philbin's favourite cafes.
Oh, yeah.
We go around with 1980s Tomorrow's World presenter Maggie Philbin.
I can really see that working.
To any of her favourite cafes.
Yeah.
Goes in, just meets people, has a chat.
Yeah.
Says, oh, this carrot cake's here, really good.
But also the bit of the history of the cafe and how long it's been a cafe and who used
the area
to own
it's
it.
In and, yeah.
All the good stories. That's lovely,
so,
yeah.
It's a shame we didn't get to pitch these, because
that's belting that one.
This is right. So that's very much maybe BBC Two, isn't
it?
That
one? Oh yeah.
Let's go ITV.
Mm-hmm.
Celebrity yuck.
Mm.
Celebrities eat things they don't really like. It's like a really toned down version of
It's a really cheap version of I'm a Celebrity.
Yeah, but really toned down just to edible foodstuffs.
Obviously, it's all edible stuff. It's not,
yeah, it's like black pudding or something.
It's not
or
like
just
donkey's
custard.
Balls and stuff like that.
They just don't like custard. So you get them to eat some custard and they just go, oh don't good. Really like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously not going to be prime time, but that might be
early
in the morning.
Motorways of Britain with Annika Rice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be nice.
What's happening here?
Just travelling around the motorways of Britain with Annika Rice. Maybe stop at the services. Maybe just
meet Maggie Philbin in the cafe.
My two, if one of the favourite. And then finally, I did go back to the dog thing because I had
Of course you did, yeah.
So it's Naked Attraction, but it's with dogs.
Ah, right. What, shaved dogs?
No, just dogs.
Right. Slowly being revealed from the ground up.
Yeah, and then see what the contestant dog thinks of the other dog. And then after they've picked, they can sniff each other's bums. Very much like the normal version, but just with dogs.
I feel like dogs would need to sniff first, because that's really important. That's probably
the show. We turn it on its head, John.
Right, okay. Yeah. You don't get to sniff now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good shout, yeah.
So it is a terrible shame, because at least two or three of those would have been made by now, wouldn't they?
It's ridiculous that you didn't get the opportunity to.
Maggie Philbin's favourite cafe.
I have to say, I really like
really
that.
Really got some legs, hasn't it?
That is working for me. Well, Tom, I don't even know where we go from there, but probably we should just leave after that.
Yeah,
That feels like the right thing to do, doesn't it? Because I don't think anything else can be said.
One thing that can be said is that we've got another sneaky in the middle show next week, haven't we?
We have,
We did an interview quite a while ago with a guy called Oliver Mull, who's got an amazing story.
Yeah.
He had like a...
It really is.
He had a migraine. You think, oh, that's quite bad. Anyone that's had migraines or gets migraines, oh, nasty. But his was like 10 months long, was it, or something?
Yeah.
He couldn't read anything. He couldn't engage his brain to do stuff properly.
He's a writer and he couldn't write.
So we have a fantastic chat with him. So have a listen.
Little sneaky bonus episode for you. Right, Tom?
Which means you've only got a week to get some writing done, John, rather than 2 weeks.
Oh, God. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a deadline. You said you wanted a deadline.
That's great.
There's a deadline.
Yeah,
you've got a bit of a deadline.
Right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Get your entries in for our competition, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?
Do you think I should I get in to try and get in touch with Maggie Philbin now, do you think?
That's probably not a bad idea. Because presumably she hasn't agreed to this yet.
She's going to have to get a list of cafes together as well. That's the thing.
You're making her do all the work, you say.
I don't want it to be one of these ones where the celebrity just pops up and someone gives her a list of cafes and she's never been there and it's
right.
obvious.
It is her favourite.
And she's
cafes.
Walking in going, oh, hello, Keith. And you can tell that Keith doesn't really know her.
Yeah.
So he's thinking, I half recognise you. And he recognises it because he used to watch Tomorrow's World back in 1989. But she's never been in the cafe before. But the researchers think, oh, it's quite a good cafe because it's like...